Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So in today's episode, I talked to Donna Davis, who was the founder of the Oregon Reality Lab here in Portland, Oregon. And she's actually in this transitional time where she's going to be moving to Florida and working still with the Oregon Reality Lab remotely and still teaching, but moving towards her retirement. But she's still actively engaged within the broader community. And so it's a really interesting conversation just because we talk about her early days in Second Life and the ways that this kind of virtual world that is still out there and persisting has proved the test of time in terms of like creating a vibrant ecosystem and economy of lots of culture that continues to develop and grow and thrive in different ways. And so there's that aspect, but also in the process of teaching right now, how do you teach different topics that are changing so quickly with all these things that are happening with AI? And they're also not a computer programming emphasis. They're doing more communications and journalism and storytelling. And so there's a way in which their program is more about these higher level principles, but also as AI comes in more and more prominently, they're able to pull off these kind of fully fledged experiences in a way that they weren't necessarily able to do before. And so, yeah, they do a lot of different projects and have been like collaborating with lots of different people from around the world. Danny Pimentel is an amazing networker and was recognized last year by the Virtual World Society as being one of the up and coming scholars to keep an eye on within the context of XR. And yeah, just some really incredible work. I'm hoping to catch up with Danny at some point here. But yeah, I wanted to sit down with Donna just to get a sense of what's happening with like higher education and XR, but also like all the uncertainties that are happening within the context of, you know, our industry. They're kind of needing to find different ways of navigating that and also preparing students to kind of like step into this uncertain future. So lots of different interesting dimensions of that problem as I have this conversation with Donna. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Donna happened on Wednesday, June 17th, 2026, in Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
I'm Donna Davis, and I am on the faculty at the University of Oregon based in Portland, where I have been since 2010. I created the Oregon Reality Lab, which is thriving right now, and from that, I also developed an immersive media communication master's program that's a fully online program in its third year. And we like to say it was the first of its kind because it really is looking at XR technologies through the lens of storytelling and communication, not necessarily from the building and platform perspective, but that's what I do and who I am. And I'm also in the process of the wind down as I'm heading towards retirement.
Nice. So maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into the space.
Sure. I was one of those students who was at midlife when I decided to go into academia. I didn't get my PhD till I was past 50. And I went into a PhD program thinking I was going to be studying family media literacy. I took an elective class in virtual worlds that was a multidisciplinary class at the University of Florida that introduced me to Second Life. So I created my avatar in 2008 as part of an elective class in my PhD program. I was so blown away. I took a hard right and never turned back. So my dissertation research that I finished in 2010 was based on building social capital in virtual worlds and understanding what avatar embodiment meant and how that created relationships and community in these environments. So that's how I got started in the space. And AWE was actually important to me in that a few years later, I was having dinner with a group of people and someone from the R Lab in New York City said, we're in that moment today in XR that we were in 10, 15 years ago when there were these new platforms called Facebook and Twitter that were coming out that nobody really understood. And that XR is that next step as we think about media technologies and communication technologies. So I extended the work that I was doing from virtual worlds to looking at XR technologies more broadly and the impact they have on humanity and the way that we can use them as powerful tools for communication.
And so what's the origin story of the Oregon Reality Lab? How did that get started?
It was such a gift. You know, serendipity is a beautiful thing. I had just as part of my National Science Foundation grant that my co-PI, Tom Belstor from UC Irvine, and I we went to San Francisco to meet with the folks, the leadership at Linden Lab, and with Philip Rosedale, which was High Fidelity at that time, and with a couple of people from our disability community, just to help the people that are building these technologies understand that lens through experience of people with disability or different types of bodies and ability. And I came back from that trip and was doing a brown bag lunch on our campus in Portland. And the provost at the time said, "You need a lab." And I said, "Yes, of course I do." And being the human being that she was, she found a space for us. And the lab came directly from that moment and the ability to help people see how these media technologies can be used, especially when they can be used for social good and making the world a better place. So we typically see headlines that, you know, game addiction and all of the stereotypes and titles that we give to people that traditionally were in these spaces. We were trying to open that up to say, look at these other potentials of these technologies. So we had the space for it, started offering classes in it. And the first class I taught in there was a hollow rectangular table, and everybody had to bring their laptops to learn. So by this second year of the lab, we had a fully functional high-end computer lab with 16 stations for game dev and learning how to build and learning how to create in these spaces. And it evolved from there. We added Danny Pimentel about 6 years ago, and my goodness, what a force he is, and has taken the lab into, again, as we look at XR more broadly, the work our students are doing, especially in wearables with Snap Specs, have been award-winning and exciting, and it's bringing a whole nother generation of people that are looking at these technologies across the spectrum of what they are capable of.
Yeah, and I'm on one of the advisory councils for the Oregon Reality Lab, where we meet and hear about what's happening with the courses. And one of the things that I have always found striking was that it's not like a game development course where there are people that are actually in the weeds of computer programming, but there is this need to tell stories, but also sometimes use the technology. But also with the advent of a lot of these AI technologies, I think probably more and more there's an ability to kind of interface with the technologies to be able to create more fully fledged experiences that maybe are easier to create now than they were when it first started. So it feels like the paradox of teaching with the Oregon Reality Lab with this kind of emerging technologies is that everything's changing so quickly. And yet academia has to, you know, in some ways you as the professors and teachers have to also adapt and evolve in a way that how you're even understanding the content and material yourself, but also being able to formalize it and understand it enough to teach it. So I'm just curious to hear, first of all, the kind of range of different courses you have more in a communication context that you're teaching for people how to address it. But then also, yeah, just sort of these changes that you have seen over the years in terms of the dynamic changing flux of what's happening in XR to have people get a degree in it, but also recognizing just how quickly everything is evolving.
I think core to our curriculum is that we look at it first and foremost from a foundational and ethical perspective. Like, what are the media theories? What are the impacts of media? As we teach a media and society class, to also lay that groundwork and create perspectives that help you understand the technologies and their impacts first. It's like, are we teaching strategy or tactics? There's lots of tactical opportunities to learn and workshops that are out there. But we want our students to be thinking about these things through those lenses of theory, ethics, research, and an awareness of impact. So we teach a media psychology class. We teach Foundations in Immersive Media, which is a class I teach that I want our students to really understand what is XR and how it's already being applied. And now we're even getting in that moment of looking at it more historically. So you can look at the early days of the launch of some of these technologies and how limited they might have been and how groundbreaking and open they became. And even in the now near 20 years that I've been in these spaces watching the evolution, I don't want to ever teach to the tactical or even platform, but instead teach from the perspective, a more global perspective and holistic perspective of what is it, how do we use it, when do we use it, when do we not use it, who do we expect to use it, and how do we reach them in ways that engage them and keep them coming back and creating and iterating and evolving with these technologies. So we teach core basic classes, building classes, so that they understand what goes into it, they understand the language of it, they understand how do I budget for it, how do I plan for it, how do I make the case for it. In one of our very first advisor meetings, we had somebody who said, well, you can't boil the ocean. You can't teach everything in what's designed to be a year and a half program. So we try to stay really focused on what is it, how do you use it, again, ethically, theoretically, and then give them some of the tools to be able to put it into practice and test it, which is the other really important thing. We're a Research One AAU university. So we're not just going to build it and hope they will come. You build it, understand who you're building for, why you're building it, and then understand impact and how do we do that responsibly and to stay curious and creative so that we're able to pivot with the ongoing changes with the technology and understand their uses and, as I say over and over, uses and impact. So next year, for example, I've built out our curriculum for most of next year, and one of our elective classes will be Children in Technology, taught by someone who came from Stanford in Jeremy Bailenson's lab, and media psychology is core to who she is and what she's teaching. And again, helping people understand the psychology and the psychological impacts of these technologies so that when they are creating, they understand why they're doing it. This is my, I don't know, sixth or seventh AWE. And one of the things I find over and over again is you could go down to the startup floor and people were always racing to market. You know, they want to be first at market with our new amazing device. But if they hadn't done the research to understand who is your audience, how accessible is it to that audience, how do you create content in these platforms that will engage them and keep them coming back, all of the things that help you create that road path to success for the long haul, not just get to market and isn't this a cool, then we run into the novelty effect where it's like, oh, that's really cool. And then you wear it for a week and then it joins the dustbin. So we really want to make sure that our students are looking at it through that long haul lens.
Yeah. And I'm curious to hear some of your thoughts and reflections on AI in terms of like the integration of AI. I think a lot of higher education has thoughts in terms of like the way that AI has disrupted different aspects of the pedagogical teaching process, of challenging of how do you keep students from not using AI in a way to bypass the journey of learning. But in terms of the project-based learning types of things that you do at the Oregon Reality Lab, it seems like maybe some sort of antidote in a way that they're using it in terms of building something that's larger than something that they could just use AI to do all of the work. There's still a lot of human labor that's required. So yeah, just curious to hear a bit more around how you've started to conceive and what's happening with AI and how the Oregon Reality Lab sort of approaches that.
It's a complicated issue and it's such an important one because we are hearing from industry that industry expects our students to be conversant in AI and understand what the tools are and how to use them. And at the same time, because our entire university and being in Oregon, I mean, we have a real strong sense of social responsibility and the ethics of these technologies. So we're trying to help our students think in terms of, especially when we're thinking about AI, is it's dramatically altering the workflow process, or it has the potential to radically alter the workflow process. And in some ways, it can be a real gift. And in other ways, it's bypassing our critical thinking. And if we let it do that, we're in deep trouble. So we're trying to help them understand the core principles of AI. I'm building a course right now for next winter on responsible use of AI so that we're not just stuffing it down their throats and saying, learn it. You know, here are all these tools. Go figure out how to play in them. Instead, it's like, when do you use AI for audio? When do you use AI for, well, just to kind of back up a little bit, I had to learn how to use COBOL and Fortran in my undergraduate program. And by the time I got to graduate school, it was HTML and XHTML. And now we have these plug and play platforms, even in XR, that are making building so much easier. So that if you learned how to build with the old tools, and if you're learning how to, I mean, things like coding, you're going to have to understand how to use AI to help you speed up that process, to help you stay competitive. And at the same time, understanding the effects of that along the way. And what is your plan for data privacy? What is your plan for retooling in a way that you have a new job? Your job hasn't been, you haven't been replaced, but you're driving the change through the way you have been able to pivot in your job to embrace some of the power of the technology while also being able to say, we aren't going to use it here because, and whatever the answer could be. So there are things, and of course, my work was originally looking at avatar identity and interaction. So as we think about interacting with digital bodies in a virtual world, how does that change if the virtual body is AI driven? And as we are seeing with new AI embodied agents and AI influencers, it's already out there, and sometimes in really terrifying ways and really unhealthy ways. And at the same time, when you're in a virtual world interacting with other avatars, how would you know that it's another human or an AI? You may not, which is also pretty terrifying, especially as we think about the age of mis and disinformation that we're in. And I'm already starting to see, I had a PhD student write a dissertation on AI use in music production, and he referred to it ultimately as Frankenstein. And that it is a bit of a horror story where you're pulling bits and pieces from multiple places to create the final product. And that, what do you lose in that process? And are you creating a monster? Or are, how do you think about the path to creating that process in a way that can elevate your creativity, elevate your outcomes and outputs efficiently? And at the same time, as I say over and over again, make sure you're using it as a tool rather than allowing it to use us as the tool to help it evolve. So how do we do that in a way that creates safety for the people that are utilizing these technologies that they don't even understand where they're at risk or vulnerable? So I would like to think our students will be thought leaders of the future evolution of these technologies that are asking those really important questions and guiding process and governing of these technologies in a way that we're able to use them safely, ethically, and efficiently, where it, I had a conversation earlier today with somebody in the media talking about if we are using AI correctly and efficiently, then it's more about job change than job loss. 100% there's going to be job loss. There is no denying that. So what happens to those people? How do they pivot? How do we create new job opportunities to hopefully fill some of those gaps? And how do we get other leaders in the field, whether that's in the government or in education or across industries, to think about keeping human at the center of this process, not profit at the center of the process? And how do we do that in a way that creates new opportunities? And that's what drives us every day.
Awesome. Yeah. Just a few weeks ago, you had announced that you're going to be entering into a transition phase of moving to Florida, but still involved with the University of Oregon and teaching this kind of liminality you find yourself in. I think the whole industry is also kind of in this liminal phase of things are ending, things are beginning. We don't quite know where the future is going. And so, yeah, I'm just curious to hear some reflections of your own personal journey of this moment of your own ending and new beginning, but also like how you're seeing this collective phase of where everything's at.
It's such an interesting and challenging time. Of course, when we're recruiting students to our graduate programs, one of the questions we always get asked is, what kind of jobs can I get with this degree? And the answer is always changing. And always changing. And we saw, and I follow diffusion of innovation and the Gartner hype cycle as I think about all of these technologies. And we see them reach the peak of inflated expectations to the trough of disillusionment. And I think at scale right now, a lot of the technologies are experiencing that trough of disillusionment. And if they didn't have strategy to get to that slope of enlightenment and long-term stability, they fail. And for me, as I look at the past 20 years near in the space and watching, oh my goodness, I'm going to Florida because that's where all my family and my people are. That was home to me before I came to Oregon 16 years ago. And I have a 2-year-old granddaughter that I am really, really looking forward to be very much engaged in her life. And I look at going back to kind of that full circle moment of family media literacy, as we think about people out there with children who are getting attached to these screens from the earliest of their days, even if I can do that one person at a time and say, how do we protect our children from the dark side of these technologies and give them access that would give them opportunities in ways we've never thought of before? You know, I have a child with a learning disability, with a brilliant mind. And sometimes these technologies can help take what's in that mind and help share it broadly in ways that our culture traditionally would not allow, because people with different types of abilities would get labeled and sidelined. And there are ways to use these technologies to give them voice and hope and opportunity. And at the same time, it's exhausting, you know, having this hope of this is going to be the one, and then it's not. This next technology is going to be the one. And I know that it's coming, and I know it's going to find a way, and I will look forward to watching and staying involved. And at the same time, looking at the opportunity to, I am one of those people that even while working on my dissertation research, I was doing all of my interviews with avatars in a virtual world. I kept all of my field notes in a leather-bound book with handmade paper with an ink pen, because to me it was really important to ground myself in the reality of that physical, those physical tools in a physical space while learning about these virtual spaces. So if I can continue to have a voice and a presence that helps us continue to find that balance, I hope I can do that even from Florida while I'll be on faculty full time still next year. The program I built is fully online. There's no reason that I cannot do it remotely. So that was a real gift. And at the same time, I hope that as I look at this next phase in my life, that I can be a voice that continues to ground people in human and planet first. And then how do we use these devices to help elevate the experience of humanity and keep the world safe? And that I won't just retire and fade off into my swimming pool, but that the ability to slow down a bit and watch with that more broad and critical lens, not being completely embedded in it in the day to day, but keeping eye on where it's going and hoping that I can still continue to have a voice, even if it's at those smaller scales of the children in my world that are coming into these environments as we, you know, the digital natives have just graduated from some of these graduate programs. And when we think about them as digital natives, backing up and saying, yeah, well, we are of this earth first. And you see a movement with Gen A and Gen Z where they're going more analog again. What does that mean to this industry? And how do you be the good neighbor in the industry that can always keep us tied to reality in a healthy way is something that I hope I can continue to be an influencer, I suppose you could say. I look at influencers and I have students will go, well, you're an outlier, Donna. You know, people your age aren't usually as cool about this. Like, thank you for that bias. and I hope I can continue to be that unusual person at my age that can help people find a safe way forward.
Yeah, and you mentioned something on the way over here, just in terms of Second Life as being like this. Kind of like, I don't think they're publicly traded, but they're just kind of like a private company that is profitable. And there's a way in which that the publicly traded companies expect a certain amount of like exponential growth over time, in a way that investing money, they want to see a certain degree of return that is growing at perhaps a much faster rate than what XR has been doing. And then AI is sort of like taking over. But being here at AWE, I'm just really struck with how many small businesses there are, where there are a lot of profitable businesses that are out there. But it's kind of like this paradigm shift of getting away from this hyperscaling exponential growth mindset. And perhaps there's this moment right now where XR is in this space of like planting these seeds where you can find real traction and organic growth in a way that is bringing value and perhaps profitability in a way that's hopefully at least sustainable. I know that there's a lot of companies that are at least struggling, or there's a waning process of things are shutting down. Things seem to be winding down in some sense. And so there seems to be a way in which the conversations I'm having here is like this real kind of liminality of someone just described, like the butterfly as it sort of gets into this kind of chrysalis and melts into this goo and has to have the imaginal cell activated before it takes off and grows. But we're in this kind of fuzzy goo of liminality of one thing ending, another beginning. But Second Life is an interesting thing to look back to as one of the OGs of the virtual worlds that are actually still around and, you know, in some sense thriving. And so just love to hear some of your perspective of someone who's been involved in the Second Life community, how you start to see what's happening in Second Life and something that's not always necessarily integrated in the larger conversation of XR, but has been there for a long, long time and maybe some valuable lessons to be learned in terms of what it might take to be in it for the long haul.
Yeah, Linden Lab, you're right. I don't believe it's publicly traded, and they're about to celebrate, I think it's the 23rd year of Second Life. And I will say that in 2008, 2009, 2010, when I was giving presentations globally about the work I was doing in that platform, I'd have people stand up and go, "You mean it's still around?" And that was, you know, nearly 20 years ago. People thought it was dead. And it is still thriving. It'll be interesting to see what they do to continue to maintain that health and well-being of the platform, as it tends to have an older demographic. And as we have seen, even in traditional media, when you count on those people that age out, what do you do to sustain yourself or recreate yourself? And I think the most important and brilliant part of Second Life is, and we've heard Philip Rosedale say this over and over again, it's entirely built by its people. The residents, the users are what create the content in there. And they're creating content that they want and that they know others want. And I've been talking to someone recently from the other side of the planet who is building an entire platform of media with its Second Life space and community at the core, but it's also now using other technologies to keep them connected when they are off world, if you will. And it's all driven by the people that are using it who are going, "Oh, I want that." So it's driven by the audience that's already there, not creating something for an audience that doesn't exist yet. And at the same time, we have to always be predictive of what's coming so that we can continue to evolve in a technological way that continues to maintain a thriving community and stable numbers. And I just have a great deal of respect for Second Life, where I get the eye roll all the time. It's like, if I hear one more "okay, boomer," you know, or all of the other disparaging things that people say about a person of my age, that sometimes we forget that there's wisdom in that age. And I think there's a great deal of wisdom in what Philip Rosedale and Linden Lab have done with Second Life that could be a model. We had a student who did a really brilliant study of avatars over the past. She built it off of a book called 1000 Avatars, and that was published 15 years ago. And when she went back and looked at where are those people now, over 30% of the population is still very actively involved 15 years later. That's phenomenal when you think about platforms. And there was another 30% she couldn't verify because there was no data that she could track, but they appeared to still be involved. And then a third of them, as we know, even during COVID, people created accounts, got in and left, you know, as they bounced. But that kind of staying power is really remarkable. And I think as people are thinking about creating platforms and experiences, if you, again, keep humans at the center of that and create an opportunity for them to be creative and them to have ownership and agency, that is, to me, that killer app that everybody's looking for. So you cannot, and I say this with frequency, you cannot just build it and assume they will come. You have to bring them with you and continue to iterate and evolve in a way that can create community and create opportunity for people that they want to come back for and to. And I think that's what Second Life has done now for almost a quarter of a century, which is remarkable in the tech world. When you think about the early ages of all of these technologies, we're not talking more than 25 years ago, really. It's all still new. And in the long haul picture of the universe or the planet, and it is exponentially growing, dying, it's like, how do you get to that one that can sustain the way Second Life and Linden Lab have done? That is the secret that they were able to tap into, that it'll be interesting to see what others, I mean, even as we watch all of the wearables and we think about the privacy and issues with privacy in wearables, it'll be just really interesting to see how governments and policymakers track with it in a way that keeps it safe and healthy for people, as opposed to the quick profit fix and then, oh, oops, sorry, we hurt people along the way. We can't think like that anymore.
Yeah, VR chat's probably the closest analog to like a social VR platform that seems to have a vibrant community and perhaps be in it in the long run, as we see the end of Rec Room within the last couple of weeks and months, as well as end of Horizon Worlds, as well as Altspace previously. So yeah, there, I think VR chat could be kind of an equivalent. Like, they don't have the same type of economy as Second Life, but at least they have like a vibrant, you know, active user base that has a lot of concurrent users each and every week. So yeah, I guess as we start to wrap up, I'd love to hear what you think is sort of the ultimate potential. Well, before we do that, I want to ask if there's, as you reflect back on your time teaching, if there's anything that you want to share in terms of what you're taking away, what you're proud of in terms of what you were able to create with this work that you've done at Oregon Reality Labs up to this point. Obviously, it's going to continue, but just as you enter this phase of transition, just reflecting upon what you're able to accomplish so far at Oregon Reality Lab.
The thing for me that has been most fulfilling is that when I came to the University of Oregon in 2010, I had the dean say, if you want to earn tenure, you might want to reconsider your research area, because none of us really understand what avatars have to do with journalism and communication. That story of my professional life, you know, it's like I've always been that outlier. And I think what I'm most proud of is that I didn't give up and I continued to evolve and grow. So where we started with a little track of classes in a strategic communication master's program, it evolved into the Oregon Reality Lab, which also led to a fully independent online graduate program in immersive media, where there's nothing I love more than seeing a student who we might take an elective who's in our strategic communication master's program or our multimedia journalism program, and they'll take an elective in our immersive program and their minds are blown. And they're like, how do I move over there? And that when that light bulb goes on, even when it's a tiny group of people, that's the seed, right? How do we help people? How do we turn those lights on in a way that people understand, I want to be part of that. I believe in that. And I see its value. And that we now have a very successful lab and a program that all came from a crazy little tradie Felissimo in Second Life in 2008. And I feel really comfortable and confident with the hands I'm leaving it in, because there are two of them instead of one of me. There'll be soon be a third one instead of one of me. And that the people that are taking over that leadership are future thinkers. They are wonderful human beings who I can't help but think they will keep the program and the lab alive and thriving and continue to be leaders in the field. And that, I think, is for me what I'm most proud of. When I have graduates that I bump into that are telling me about the work they found, oh, my life is full, you know, it's my heart is full. It's like I'm watching it and they are going to be the thought leaders that will drive the change in this field. And that's what I'm most proud of, really.
Yeah, one of the lessons learned in this conversation is always be aware what kind of electives you're taking, because you never know where it's going to change your complete life course. So yeah,
100%. And I've seen it happen in our program where people will come and take one of our classes and as an elective, and it's like, I'm in. I want to stay here. And it's that passion that's also going to be how this industry continues to evolve successfully. It takes that kind of passion and understanding that hopefully is what we're teaching in our program and in the lab.
Great. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of all these immersive technologies with XR, VR, AR, mixed reality, AI, all coming together? And what do you think that they might be able to enable?
The thing that excites me most about all of it is that I remember interviewing Hazel Henderson decades ago, and in her book on futures, she talked about a line that wasn't unique to her, thinking locally, acting globally, and that these are platforms that allow us to act globally and connect globally, that at a time where we are so polarized, that if we can use these technologies to break down some of those walls and look at each other's as global citizens and neighbors, that we can learn from each other and find out that, wow, we really do like a lot of the same thing. We're all humans with the same passion and the same hopes, especially as we think about next generations. And, you know, how do we leave it in a good place? And I think these technologies have a chance to connect us in ways globally that I don't see happening in any other platform or field. And as we think about even the health of the planet, and we can do these things without flying across the world, how do we use these to connect us globally and help us understand each other locally and globally? I think through the powerful storytelling that can be done using these technologies that can take people to places and cultures that they never might have been exposed to. And they always say travel is one of those things that help us understand others and the planet. Why not use these as opportunities to do that kind of travel, even if it's virtual, that allows people an opportunity to experience things they may otherwise never have access to and inspire them in ways that they may not otherwise have been inspired.
Brilliant. And is there anything else that Stefan said that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Keep going and always keep humans at the center. Understand the power of what we do and do it responsibly, ethically, and in a way that leaves us all in a better place.
And because it is a virtual program, I guess you are open to having students come in. Maybe just talk a bit about the process. If people want to know more information, what should they know? Where should they go?
To know more about the program, our website is journalism.uoregon.edu, and there are links to our graduate programs where they can learn all about our immersive media program. And applications start in, I think, September. So take a look, and they're always welcome to reach out to me, even if I'm in Florida. I'll be actively engaged at least for the next year. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, Donna, thanks so much for joining me and to sharing a little bit more about your journey and also what's happening with the Oregon Reality Lab and your whole journey with that. But also this sort of like liminality of like the uncertainty of the future. I think that's kind of the nature of emerging technologies, but kind of embracing that. And, you know, the students that have come there seem to have find different spots within the XR industry and perhaps, you know, some even ending up at Apple and other big companies. And so, yeah, it's just really nice to see how the program has been going and having students come through. And it's been a pleasure to be able to kind of bear witness to it in the advisory committee and participate in different ways. So yeah, it's just great to be able to sit down with you as you're in this transition moment, the ending of your own cycle and beginning of the next. So yeah, thanks again for joining me here on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Kent. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast and for keeping the faith for where this industry is going here in the future. I feel like this is a kind of weird time for everybody in the industry. And if you believe in where this technology may go and that it may be able to bring about positive social change and transformation in the world, then please do consider supporting me here at the Voices of VR podcast, trying to navigate these dimensions of transformation and positive change for where all this might be going. So if you enjoy the coverage that I'm doing here, then please do consider becoming a member at patreon.com/voicesvr. Thanks for listening.